Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we are joined in the studio by one of America's most prominent writers of Western fiction, Max Evans. Two of his books, The Rounders and The High-Low Country, were made into movies and are household names. And at the age of 86, Mr. Evans has just published his latest work of fiction, War and Music. Max Evans, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, Max, I want to talk to you about your writing, of course, and how The Rounders kind of changed your life by changing you from a kind of a cowboy to a scriptwriter in Hollywood. But even before that, your life that you had been living was completely different than the one that most of us live. You grew up on a ranch. You were a working cowboy. At 17, you owned your own ranch. Then you were a miner. You were a mine owner. You were an artist, a poet, and then a nonfiction writer. And the thing that kind of amazes me about all this is that you seem to like doing each of those things, but then you kept doing different things. And I'm kind of wondering why.
I have no idea why I would do such a thing, because if you did, you wouldn't do it. It's going to throw your tail in a spin every time when you change from one dedicated movement in the direction that you've chosen, for instance, writing, painting, cowboying, or one maybe has chosen you.
The aspect that seemed to have the biggest effect on your fiction anyway was your life as a cowboy and your living in New Mexico. That seemed to really impact your novels.
Well, I think it's very perceptive, especially the living in New Mexico part. My life as a cowboy came about almost by accident, and as far as actually going out and working on other ranches and making a hand myself. But when I was a very small child during the Great Depression and the Great Drought, my aunt was widowed with six little daughters, and just stair-step. And she had these cattle, and there was no one to take care of them. And by the time I was 6 years old, I was taking care of her cattle and riding horseback and learning all about the prairies and outdoors and how to survive, how to handle cattle, how to take care of her to make her feel good, make her feel like she could live. And that's led to me being a cowboy. I didn't just choose being a cowboy. And then I kept hearing wondrous stories of northern New Mexico, of Taos and Santa Fe, in that area. Every now and then I'd hear some old cowboy would come through and talk about it. And I couldn't wait. I just couldn't wait. I wanted to go there and be there with the Indians and the Latinos and the cowboys and the whole thing. And I did. I did when I was just before I was 12 years old. I was still 11 years old when I went to Glorieta Mesa to get my first job on a cow ranch.
You write in the 50th anniversary foreword to The Rounders, which you've just reissued, that the reason you wrote The Rounders was that you were in serious debt, and you wrote this work of fiction to get out of debt. And I have to say that from my perspective, that sounds like kind of a weird game plan, to write a first work of fiction to get out of debt.
Well, I just left a very weird game plan, the mining business. From being a cowboy and an artist already, I'd sold about 300 paintings and a little bit during the period that I was in the mining business. You must say that no matter what I chose, it wouldn't be any crazier than what I'd already done. I couldn't figure anything crazier. Probably I would somehow or other have gotten around to it. But instead of millions, which we could have cashed in for at one time, for over a year's period, we were afflicted with the oldest disease known, greed. And we thought we would...
So that's not a new thing in 2010, greed?
Not at all. And the price of copper dropped from 90 cents in half, just flat in half in 90 days, and broke us. And I was $86,000 in debt. Okay, it's very simple. Going back to cowboying at 40, now I could draw $40, $45 a month. Wasn't going to ever pay off $86,000.
So you could work the math.
It just wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
And I it'd take me 18 months to get enough paintings to start showing and selling again. And so I'd been writing, selling little magazine stories and enjoying it and being thrilled by it, paid very small, I must say. But I had heard about people writing books and making a lot of money, and I decided, well, I'll just try one. I know about cowboys, and I've lived with them and worked with them, so I'll try that. And that's how the Rounders came about.
So let's talk about the Rounders. Can you tell us a little bit about what the basic story is or what the book's about?
Well, you know, the real working cowboys back in those days, just prior to World War II and right after, just after the barbed wire fence took over our West, they were out there and they didn't have any radio, any TV, any newspaper, any telephone, no post office, no communication. So I had noticed that they still had fun out of life. And I'd watched that and observed it. And it was the camaraderie of these people with nothing and really dangerous, daily dangerous work. Their life is on the line almost daily. And I thought, that's never really been told about the American cowboy, that part of it. Will James was great. He was the first realist of the West. But he never did, for some reason, I don't know why, he never did take them to town and show how they dreamed about blowing a winter or a month or a winter's wages and what all they were going to do with it. He never showed that. And I thought, that's never been done anywhere in the world. I'll just do it.
And you do. You do it very well. I mean, it's sort of interesting because on the surface, there's this emotional distance between the characters and this masculinity. But then there's just below the surface, you know, what the reader gets is you can really relate to each character, and there's this this bond that forms between the characters that's truly amazing.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that, just coming right off the top of my head here, every day they're going to depend on one another to live. There's going to be a situation when you're out actually working cattle in very rough country, horseback, maybe 20, 25 miles, 10, 15 from the nearest ranch house, and your life is on the line, and that guy comes through for you and comes in there and does his part, puts his life to save yours or get you out of a jackpot. Every day is many chances when you're working cattle to be completely crippled for life. Every day. And when that happens, there's a bond of trust that lasts forever.
There's a third character, main character in the book, that's a horse called Old Fooler. The horse is maybe the best character in the book. Did you write that actually about an animal, or is that about more like a person that you turn into an animal, or do you have a sense that animals have this kind of distinctive personality that Old Fooler has?
They all do, just like people. And you get to where you recognize it because you know the movement. They know your moods. You know their moods. You work with them. Their life's on the line. Your life's on the line over and over and over together, as it is with your workmates. And you get a closer understanding of the whole world by knowing these animals. And I have never met a ranch person in my life, my long, long life, that had read this book or saw this movie that didn't tell me I had an Old Fooler. Every one of them had
really?
An Old Fooler.
Because this
we
Old
all
Fooler,
have Old Foolers.
This Old Fooler kind of has a mind of his own.
Yes.
And has a strategy in order to kind of live the life that he wants to live, and he's not going to let someone else kind of tell him what to do.
Well, they try and try, but
right.
He always wins. It doesn't matter. He always wins.
You know, I wonder, Max, if you could just read a little bit of the Rounders for us, just to give us a sense of your writing and give the readers a better appreciation of what it's like to read something that you've written.
Now, these guys have been out working cattle.
Yeah, this is Dusty and Wrangler.
Dusty and Wrangler.
The two main characters.
Two main characters. They've been out for months gathering wild cattle for their boss. He's talked them into it in really rough country, and they've gone through a tough winter, and it's spring now, and they've had a really rough day gathering cattle, and they haven't got anything done, and they stopped to water their horse at a tank, their horses, and one of them's riding Old Fooler, and the ice is thin, as it is in early spring, on these ponds, and even sometimes on running streams where it eddies. So this old horse suddenly decides he wants to have some more fun with this old boy after a terrible day of work, and one of his partners raises his hand to pull his hat down, and he uses that as an excuse and just jumps right out in this icy pond. So here they are coming home, and this is what he's thinking, telling his buddy. Wrangler roped him, and here's where we start. Then Wrangler roped me. It was not a clean loop. It went around my neck and down under one arm. He turned around and spurred off like he was trying to jerk down a yearling bull. I came out of there like a catfish hooked right in the jaw. He drugged me a ways before he turned around and let some slack in the rope. I yelled, "God Almighty, stop! I'd rather drown and be drugged to death." Now, spring was easing up on us, but the middle of it was not here yet. That ride home that evening, after the sun had set, was not one of great comfort. The wind was blowing too hard, but as wet as I was, I could have felt the breath of a prairie dog from 20 feet underground. I said, "Well, this son of a buck has now tried everything in the world to kill me. He has run through corrals, barbed wire fences, jumped off a bluff, rolled over me, kicked me in the belly, bit me in the back, run me into a tree, bucked me off and left me afoot, and now he's tried to drown me. You know what I'm going to do with this dirty bastard Wrangler? I'm going to take him into town and sell him to a soap factory. Then I am going to buy the first bar of soap they make out of him. I'm going to wallow around in cow for a week. Then I'm going to bathe with that dirty SOB. And every time I wash my hands from them on, I'm going to laugh like hell. That's what I'm going to do."
That's a great reading, Max. This is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio Max Evans, who is one of the great writers of Western fiction. He just read something from his book, The Rounders. And Max, what comes through in your reading is something I certainly noticed when I was reading it, is you pack paragraphs with zingers. There's humor in every paragraph. There's a zinger or two in every paragraph. Was that intentional on your part? You think, look, when I'm writing this thing, I better pack this in, or does it just come to you that way?
It came to me that way because that's the people I'd lived with and worked with, and that's the way they talked. That's the way they thought, the way they felt. They survived out of humor and camaraderie. Their camaraderie was marvelous, still is. Not nearly like it was, because they have other methods of entertaining themselves now. They have television and used to have newspapers and magazines and radio, all sorts of things. They had none of that, none of that. And it was their own wit and their own observation of life that formed this natural humor. And they could hardly talk without it. There was so much tragedy in everything they did all day long.
Yeah, there's sadness and tragedy and lonesomeness, and yet there's this overriding humor that pervades the book.
And that was their absolute, I didn't know Islay was about 1,000 years old, but that was their way of total survival. That was their only way of survival, and it worked, and it became part of them, a natural part of them.
Well, you know, we talked earlier that your game plan to me didn't make any sense. You were going to write The Rounders and make all this money, and lo and behold, you write The Rounders, and it seems to have been immediately picked up by Hollywood, and someone's interested in making it into a movie. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know how in the hell it happened.
I came across a story about you in Hollywood, and I don't know if it's true, but there's this story, at least on the internet, that says that that you tried to kill Sam Peckinpah.
Well,
is that a true story?
No, if I'd have tried to kill him, he'd have been buried 10 years earlier than he was. I tried to break his neck. I didn't want him to die. And
So is there any reason why you tried to break?
Oh yeah, Dave.
And Sam Peckinpah, we should say, he ended up being a friend of yours, right? And he's kind of a famous director, Straw Dogs and The Wild Bunch and a lot of other movies.
Yeah, Ride to High Country is what I first knew him for. Yeah, he's one among the immortals now. Fellini and Scorsese and John Huston and those guys. He's ranked right with them. But to me, he was just a wonderfully talented madman. I loved him for his madness and the way he'd turn out films and fight anybody, fight the studio. He didn't keep friends, I think, very long. They couldn't handle it. And I don't know how we came about that run-in that night, but he had dumped an ashtray in my drink. And he thought he'd done it on the sly. And I don't know what he thought would be funny about that. But I had swallowed about half a cigarette, and I choked up on that. So I never thought about it. I just grabbed him, and I was a lot younger and a lot stronger then than I am now, of course. And I picked him up about shoulder high, and I was going to hit the floor to the back of his head and break his neck. And I thought, well, he'll have to go around with it. The thing tied around his throat, and he can't cuss everybody and make everybody insult everybody. But I got the wrong end, and I broke his leg instead. So he was sitting there on the floor and yelling at me and wanted to know why I did that. You know, he was innocent. He was innocent. And I walked over and patted him on top of the head and really commiserated with him. I really felt sorry for him. I told him that I hoped he'd forgive me that I had meant to break his cockeyed neck and only a leg. It was a nice break right on his ankle. The X-ray showed a real nice, almost perfect crosshair.
So he was lucky.
Yeah.
So if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz, and we're talking to Max Evans, who is more than a writer of Western fiction. He's just come out with a new book at 86 called War and Music, and I'd like to talk to you some now, Max, about your new book, War and Music. And I know you don't want to give away the plot and the storyline, but I don't think it's giving away much to say that the book at least features the Normandy invasion, which was something that you actually were part of, the invasion of Normandy.
Omaha Beach and D1, yeah.
Listeners may not be aware of the tremendous scale of that invasion. There were over 300,000 American troops, over 300,000 British troops, plus a lot of other troops. How soon did you land in terms of when the invasion started? How quickly did you land?
I'd have no idea. We started two or three times, and everybody was seasick, and everybody that I saw, and so I have no idea.
Were you part of the first group that went?
Not the first group, but the first, I don't know what you'd call it. It's just people everywhere. There's people ahead of you, people behind you, people to the side of you.
And this is true for Ty Hale, your main character in War and Music. He's part of that group, too, that goes.
Yeah, I wrote the War and Music as a love story, and hoping people would understand the totality of the dimension of music in all of our lives, how it ties all humanity together, and what how individuals can gather and grow with an appreciation for music that gives them peace and health, helps their health. It's one of the healthiest things in the world. And so there's only one thing stronger than war and music that exists, and that's real love. So I decided that since I'd been challenged my whole life, that every book I'd ever done was different from the others, which is not good business, but it's good for your soul. And I assume I have one. I've been writing about souls for about 60 years now, so there better be a soul here somewhere. But I wanted to tell the love's the only thing stronger than war and music in human association. And if you get the three of them together and tell the truth and tell it right, I think it might make people feel good. I think this book, a little book, has a healing quality about it. But
one of the things about your books is they're short. They're novellas. And, it reminds me of this story I told a judge once when he asked why my brief was so long. And I told him he gave me a short briefing schedule, so I didn't have time to write a good short brief. I just had to write a lousy long one. And your works are really novellas, and this is too.
Yeah, nearly all my best works are novellas. I have one, Blue Feather Fellini, around 800, 900 pages long. I call it the world's longest short story because when I thought of it, finished thinking of it, which I'd thought about for over 35 years, I'd planned that Blue Feather Fellini book. It, by the way, is not a cowboy in 800 pages, but there's everything else that there is in New Mexico. And it's the only really long book, but as I swear to you, I had 36 books that I'd thought up, and I realized I couldn't do that. I couldn't live long enough. I didn't think I'd live two or three more years when I was working on this thing. And So I just jumped on it.
What comes to you first? Like in war and music, you talk about war, music, and love. What was your process?
Well, I didn't think of anything first. I had realized long ago, even before I was in war, just reading things from the old masters. I'd always read ever since I was a little bit of kid. I read Balzac and Dostoevsky and Chekhov and all those kind of people. And I don't know, I was obsessed with it. And it seemed to me that it's just the three things are interlocked. There's no escaping, ever. I don't care what you do. People spend their lives trying to escape beauty. When I say war, there's beauty in war and everything else. Even in war, I found beauty because there was love and music with it.
Well, but your description in the book, anyway, of the war is pretty horrific. I mean, these American soldiers are coming on this beach. The Germans have the high ground. They're aiming these guns at them. The American soldiers are literally sitting ducks. It seems like the strategy was simply to overwhelm the Germans with people. You know, there simply wasn't a good way to get a beachhead other than that.
Well, we just had after 6 weeks of terrible fighting, it never stopped because the whole country was from the beach on back was hedgerows, and each hedgerow was a little farm, is what it was, a little plot of a farm, a huge rock. It'd been there hundreds and hundreds, maybe 1,000 years, some of them in there. Every one was a fortress, so it didn't stop. You had to take one fort after another, you never stopped. And it was.
The Germans were dug in behind the
hedgerows. Yeah, and when you finally rooted them out, you lost a lot of people, you know. But we had an advantage. We had a great air force, and we had almost destroyed theirs. So we had that advantage.
Yeah, there were 12,000 aircraft that supported that invasion. That's just an amazing number.
Yeah. Well, I had the only thing I could. If you'll notice in the book, even though the war is really a small part of it. I didn't really get into the details of the war till after the St. Lo breakthrough, mm-hmm. which was critical. They had stopped us, which sounds impossible with all the armor and the air power we had. But the Germans were really fighting machines. They had been brainwashed to just die if they had to, and they were really tough, and we were just hanging on.
Can I interrupt you? What was your mentality? What was the mentality of the American soldier?
Well, first you're scared, so scared that you don't know hardly what you're doing. That's the first thing that happens to you, and then you like a cowboy, you develop a relationship of life and death with the man next to you, and the one on the other side. And I always called it that war was not a huge thing. It was just a 20-yard circle. That's all you really know. But at the breakthrough at St. Lo, we got to observe before we broke through the greatest flight of war planes that it was ever in the history of humankind or ever will be. We got to watch them, and the wind shifted and blew the smoke. It was the smoke bombs that designate their target, and the wind shifted, and we got a lot of the bombs. They claimed only 500 men were hit, but I guarantee you that was just a cover-up, and I suppose will remain so. But we got to witness the massiveness there in the sky, and we realized, I can never forget this tiny little thing. And I hate talking about war. You've got me doing it somehow or other. But I always would just stretch out on my back because I wanted to look at the sky when I was in the foxhole. In case a shell came in, well, I'd be looking at the sky. When they bombed to St. Lowe, the planes actually were in the sky from horizon to horizon. And it was a drone like the whole world had turned to a beehive. It's just a drone. And that sound alone is unforgettable.
Must have been frightening.
It was the music, you see, of war there in the sky. And the little planes, little fighter planes, looked like little mosquitoes flying around and around and around. And when the bombs fell, our own bombs, well, you hear the cliches, but the skin, the top of the foxhole kept opening and closing. The skin of the earth was so impacted that I was scared again, just like I was in the very beginning. I was so scared I was just paralyzed. And because I thought I was just going to be buried alive there. And I guess, I don't know what I was scared of. I know that's one thing. And then you hear the yell, and everybody gets up, and the survivors attack. And they fought straight through. They broke through at St. Lowe. If they hadn't broken through at St. Lowe, which was only 20 miles in from the beach, you got to think of this.
That's
amazing. We were literally hanging on by our fingernails. It isn't like it was told. It is not like it was told. If we hadn't have been successful, that we had 20,000 casualties in that one little town in 3 days to break through, but we did. And then we went on to take all the hedgerows after that.
You know, Max, we're nearing the end of the show, and you're 86 years old. You've written yet another work of fiction here. And I'm wondering, what's next? Are you going to keep writing? What are you going to do?
I'm not going to write any more fiction. It's too damn hard. I'm going I can't do any better in this book. You know, the love stories, the nature that's in it, the war is a small part of this book. And the love stories, the driving force, and the music, that and the singing, the wonderful singing of the woman he's in love with, and all of that. I can't write any better than that.
Max Evans, I'd like to thank you so much for coming into the studio. Thanks also to my producer, John Burgund. This is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. A podcast of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. If you've missed one of my past shows or would like to re-listen to part of it, please check out my new website, The Spitz Report, and thanks for listening to KUNM.